You're listening to a DM podcast.
Hi, I'm Nigel Marsh, and this is the Five of My Life podcast, the show where five choices reveal sideways insights into the lives, opinions, and lessons of interesting people.
Multi-award-winning Robert Connolly is one of Australia's most acclaimed filmmakers, with an international career spanning over 30 years. Perhaps best known as the director and writer of Balibo and the producer of Romulus My Father, this conversation took place soon after he reunited with Eric Bana to make the sequel to their popular feature film, The Dry.
So Robert, welcome to Five of My Life.
Lovely to be here, Nigel. Lovely to chat to you.
Congratulations. Yesterday morning, which felt slightly weird, I was in the cinema watching your latest film, and it's bloody fantastic. Absolutely sensational. So good on. That's going to be a smash hit.
I'm so glad you could see it in a cinema.
We should mention the title, actually, shouldn't we?
Force of Nature, The Dry 2, the sequel to The Dry. But I think for me, it's such an important thing to go to the movies, to sit in the cinema. I've always loved that experience since I was a kid. And, you know, we have so many opportunities to watch stuff at home. So thank you for getting up and going to the movies in the morning.
Well, I feel very special because I don't know who the other people were, journalists and critics and things. I thought, oh, look at me.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, no, we made the film. We shot on big widescreen lenses. And, like, I think the challenge for filmmakers now is to make films that have to be seen at the cinema. And so with Force of Nature and The Dry, we're really trying to make these big epic Australian films. So anyone who writes off going to the movies, it's such a fun communal experience. You know, I love it.
One of the things that struck me very powerfully was those big wide shots of the rolling hills and the rain and the mist and the green. Just a real sense of the forest and the nature. Just incredible.
Yeah, well, that world that the five women get lost in is incredible part of Victoria, where I now live. I grew up in the Blue Mountains, but I now live down there. It's fascinating. People don't really think that outside Melbourne, you've got the Otways, the Dandenong Ranges, the Latrobe Valley, the Yarra Valley, and that these places are almost prehistoric. You know, you look at that subtropical rainforest. It's not what you think, is it? It doesn't feel like the Victoria that we think more of, a Ned Kelly scrubby.
That's it.
When you think of how cinema depicts it. So I took the crew out into that in the middle of winter. It was incredibly tough shoot, incredibly. The things we put Eric Bana through, it was madness. But I loved it. And again, I think, you know, cinema is a great way to take people into those places, to take you somewhere you've never been. I love that sense of landscape.
What a great cast as well. I mean, are they people that you've worked with throughout your career or?
Oh, my, I couldn't believe my luck. So Eric, of course, is my friend. We're in business together. We've got a company and an office that we hang out in. For the last 10 years, he's a great guy. And then my wife, Jane Norris, is a casting director. So she casts all my films and keeps me honest. And she is incredible. She found Cece Stringer and Lucy Ansell, emerging actors no one's seen before. But then someone like Deborah Lee Furness back on our screens. Yes, we haven't seen it. And she's dynamite. An actor in it who my daughters just think is incredible is Anna Torv. And who obviously we know from the newsreader here, but The Last of Us, she was just nominated for an Emmy. And Tony Briggs, who wrote The Sapphires. I mean, it's an ensemble piece, even though Eric is the movie star. Richard Roxburgh.
He was looking good, actually. He'd been hitting the gym, I reckon. He looked, or maybe it was on location. You weren't feeding him properly.
He's a good-looking guy. I love how with that character he kind of talked about the inspiration of Elon Musk, and he said, "I have to drive a Tesla as this corporate figure." But it's interesting working with him because when I first met Eric Bana, Richard directed the film Romulus, My Father, that I produced in 2007.
Yeah, great film. Yeah.
So now I'm directing this one with Eric, and we said, "Oh, why don't we ask Richard to come and do a supporting role?" So it had a little bit of getting the family back together.
Oh, wonderful. I pride myself of being generalist. So we're not a political show, but we've done Gillard and Rudd and Albanese. We're not a rugby show, but we've done Pocock and Eels and Eddie Jones. We're not a filmmaking show, but we've done lots of actors and also some filmmakers. So people like David Caesar, Emil Sherman, John Colley, are any of those names familiar?
I know them all really well. They're all amazing. I mean, John Colley's having great success with Boy Swallows Universe, which is out at the moment. David Caesar, a really inspiring filmmaker, actually, early in my career. He made a film, Mullet, which I recommend with Ben Mendelsohn down in Kiama, which is fantastic. And Emil, of course, just huge success with his company, Seesaw, making film and television all over the world. I think of some of their great films like Lion, which I still think is one of Australia's great works of cinema. So they're an impressive trio to follow.
Well,
I feel flattered that you've invited me.
We better get into your choices. So we start with the film. Well, there's a link for you. And you have chosen one of the films. It was fascinating. I mean, I rewatched it, but reading about it, it's regarded as one of the best, most influential films ever made. It's 2001, A Space Odyssey, Kubrick's masterpiece. So two things. One, tell me about it and why you've chosen it. But two, I don't get it.
Yeah, I know. It is a poem and it is a...
A poem, did you say?
It's a poem of a film. You know, it's got the three chapters. And I guess I was nine and living in the Blue Mountains. And my brother was eight. And my mum took the two of us down from the Blue Mountains to the Roma Cinema. Some people may remember opposite the George Street Cinemas, this little art house cinema, to see a documentary, The Bible as History, you know, two good young Catholic boys. And the film was terrible. Like, it was absolutely terrible. And at the end of it, I'll never forget, my mother has passed on, and she's hugely influential on me as a young person. But she looked at these two little boys and what she just put us through. And she took us down the road. And 2001, which was 10 years old, but it was a reprisal, was playing on a 70mm print. And she went, I'll take the boys to see that. But of course, the religious experience that day was seeing 2001. Yeah. I came out of there and my mind had been blown. It was the cryptic nature of it. And I think it takes years to understand it. And you only understand it in your own personal way. I've got a book on my shelf in my office, which is reviews of all the films where critics got it wrong. And there are some great reviews of 2001 where people say this film will never survive. It's boring.
Incoherent.
It's rubbish. This film, and they're written by great critics.
Nice.
And it was misunderstood. And I think it is a puzzle. And I was kind of disappointed they ended up making a film 2010, like a sequel that kind of made sense of it. And it's like, well, no, I guess in my own work, I've always loved films with a question mark ending. Like even at the end of The Dry, you don't know what's going to happen. Eric Banner walks off down this valley. And I think I've always loved the idea that cinema doesn't have to answer everything, that there's a world you exist as an audience member outside the work, the contemplation, the discussion. And of course now the social media, the reading, the, you know, Q&As, even a discussion like this about my work, you know, it fills in the painting a bit more thoroughly. And 2001 is magic. But yeah, I'll never forget. I never really got to talk to my mum about it. I should, you know, but I then went on to have a career as a filmmaker. Something was set in motion that day by seeing 2001. And I've revisited it many times and I still think it's a triumph, actually.
Well, so all these years later, it's actually quite prescient, if that's the right word, in terms of AI.
Oh.
I can't believe I'm watching it in your honour again, slightly irritated.
Sorry to make you watch it.
I'm not just saying this because you're here, but I enjoyed yours more.
I love that. I love that you struggled with it. It's you're right. The Hal thing. Like you're talking about a film made in the late 60s.
Yeah, and he's talking about AI. Yeah. Incredible.
And
incredible.
Also, for anyone who's played with AI, ChatGPT and the early versions of that before, as they say, you know, it was lobotomized. That's how they describe what happened when they realized AI. They talked about these AI platforms that we all have access to now. They're a bit more moderate, but when they first were introduced last year, they went into a hallucination state. And if you could get them into a hallucination state, they would say random, crazy stuff. And as a creative person, you find that fascinating. So how is this computer thinking in a creative space? So if you think of Hal in 2001 going off the rails and they have to turn it off, and if you think of the conversations that are had with Hal, they're not that different to the conversations you can have with the kind of basic AI that we all have access to now. So he was incredible. I mean, it wasn't just Stanley Kubrick. I guess Arthur C. Clarke as a writer was, as all great science fiction, was kind of a fortune teller, really. He kind of looked into the future and predicted things.
Tell us about your mum and your childhood.
We grew up in East Blaxland in the Lower Blue Mountains, and we moved to England, lived there for 3 years in the early 70s, which was very influential if I think back on it.
Influential in what way?
Well, taking a young family, you know, in the early 70s, you got, you know, I think we're like 5 and 6 year old boys, and taking us and going living in London in that time, it's pretty, and then travelling around Europe in a combi van for months, and it's kind of show, it shows you a world outside your own doors, you know, and it kind of lays the foundation for you to dream about this larger place that you can inhabit. And I always think, you know, that generation of travel, when I think of my parents, it's pretty interesting. Like, there's no Lonely Planet guides. Yep. There's no Google Maps. You know, I remember them talking about we went to Japan and wandering around Japan in 1973. There's no English signs anywhere. You know, it's a different era of travel. The adventure of travel is something I love and very passionate about. And I think my parents instilled that. But then I guess growing up in the mountains and with a film like Force of Nature, my childhood was very much like the flashbacks in Force of Nature. I'm very much inspired by that. My father and my mother taking us into the bush and teaching us how to be respectful of it and how to love it and admire it. And so that bit of Force of Nature is a bit of a love letter to my parents and the bush.
We're going to go to your second choice, which is actually, it's the first novel that Tim Winton got listed for the Booker, his seventh novel, The Riders.
That's right.
Tell us why you've chosen that.
I have a great love of that book. I've worked with Tim on a few other books. I adapted his book, The Turning, into a compendium film with 17 filmmakers. Last year I did his family film, Blueback. And The Riders for me feels like the one that got away. I was attached to direct it, and we tried for a while. It's fascinating thinking back to 2001 because The Riders has a question mark ending. It doesn't all resolve.
That's right. It exactly also, what you've just been talking about, yeah.
Yeah, it leaves you going, what happened?
Where's
the wife? So you can't, and it again asks you to contemplate beyond the book, outside the book, and it is a great story of a father and a father of a daughter. I'm the father of two daughters myself, and the kind of complexity of that dynamic, I think, is very cinematic, you know, watching the way they navigate loss and grief and the mystery of what's happened. And it's international, you know, it's set in Ireland and Europe, even though they're Australian characters. And that really was the beginning of a kind of view of, you know, the world and how Australian stories can be told in the world. Like back in the day when I was at uni studying theatre, you know, the great Australian playwrights like David Williamson and Jack Hibbert, who'd set our national story on the screen, had put our story on stage, were kind of confronted by Louis Narron and Stephen Sewell. Both of their first plays were set in Russia. So these new writers come along and say, why can't we tell stories set in other parts of the world? And I love that about The Riders, and I still do. I mean, I hope, you know, it's a long career. Someone else is trying to make it, and I hope maybe with good fortune that the planets could line up and I could have another opportunity to perhaps direct it, or that someone else will, and I would love to see that too.
It's been made into an opera. Have I got that right?
It may have been, actually. Yeah, it may have been, yeah.
And tell us the story. I don't want to trigger you, but I'd love to hear a disastrous film story because I've got my own little story that I'll tell you. were you fired in a fit of pique from the film, or you lost the funding, or what happened?
It's a, you know, yeah, it's a kind of, I don't know, the tragedy of getting so close to making a film. And it was an Australian producer based in London, who was developing it, and I was attached, and I went to the UK and I was meeting with a lot of amazing actors who were attaching and crew, and so it was advancing. But it's interesting, I wasn't sacked off the project, or it didn't kind of collapse in a heap in a way. In some ways I wish it had been a bit more brutal because it was like a slow
death.
Yeah, and I think films are hard. They're hard to crack. I think every film I've made is a miracle. Like, I'm delighted every time I make them. I don't take them for granted. And it's a cryptic puzzle how to fund them. And this one was just tricky. It just had so many, and it had so many challenges. I think the kind of abstract nature of certain elements of it probably made it a bit harder for the more conservative financiers to understand. You know, the question mark ending, like, but what happened? We need to know. Or the visual metaphor of the writers themselves, you know, these men returning.
How are we going to do that?
You know, and what does it mean? But I do know one thing. I think cinema ebbs and flows in its taste. You know, we're definitely coming out of a superhero phase. We're on the wane. I've heard some of the leading figures in the Hollywood system talk about how audiences want authenticity more than anything. After more than a decade of VFX-heavy superhero films, that they're feeling audiences kind of gravitating to visceral, authentic, honest, emotional stories. Mm. And I think of my childhood, you know, of all the Westerns. Remember a time when all the films America made were Westerns and no one ever thought that would end. They thought that would go on forever. Yes. And, of course, it waned and then it disappeared quite quickly. And I think we're seeing the same thing happening with all the superhero films. And what I love about that, and if you think historically, that period of the Westerns when they ended, the filmmakers like George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, the thrillers of the 70s, the Harrison Ford fun, guilty pleasure films that were action films and fun, like cinema changed. And I think of the kind of 90s as a fun, playful time where cinema kind of got a bit of a wink and, you know, a cheeky kind of playful thing again. I don't know where we're going now, but I do know that we're going somewhere different, which is exciting.
Yeah.
And even if a film like The Riders as an adaptation of Tim's wonderful book didn't happen then, it's a nut stored. There will be a time where audiences' tastes have shifted and they want things that are more surprising and a little bit less literal.
You couldn't meet anyone who knew less about filmmaking than me, but I did have one book that was bought three times by three different people, including in America. So I had that experience.
What was it?
It's a book called Fat, 40 and Fired. But
Your book. I didn't realize that you were saying your book adapting. Yeah, I thought you as a... Oh, no, of course, your book. In fact, I remember it being sent to me. I remember your book being sent to me.
Oh, well, you say you're one of them.
No, and someone saying, this could make... When I first read it, and it was like... And going, oh, this could make a great film, or what could it be? And so I think it's fascinating. Let's talk about you for a minute. So did it get close?
If you are an amateur, a non-film person like me, making a film is like putting a raw steak in a room.
Yeah.
And then asking people every now and then to walk in and breathe on it to cook it.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And you go, well, that is my experience. And from that, you go, A, it's amazing that you, Emil, whatever, can actually make a film. Then if you have done that, if I look at the sort of the Venn diagram, you go, so you take all the films that could be made and you go, well, lots of them, most of them won't be because it never works. But then the ones that do actually get financed, everything is making it almost... guaranteed that it will be crap. There's two hurdles. You go, can you get the finance? And then once you have got the finance and whoever is left standing and whatever you're at is, it's probably going to be shit.
Well,
so to make a good film is astonishing.
Yeah. Someone told me, and this has really haunted me, but it is true. The difference between a great film and an ordinary film is about five decisions.
Right.
It's not 50.
Yes.
It's not 100. It's
yes.
about five.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is, as a director, those decisions can happen really fast. You can be on set and they can come up and say, what do you think about this jacket that, you know, blah, blah, you know, is wearing? And you might look at it and for a moment think, oh, you know, it's not quite, and just agree. And then be looking at the finished film. And I've seen this in films where a working class character is wearing a designer jacket.
Yes. Yes.
And you watch the film and it all of a sudden feels fake. Well, that's one of the five choices. So the heartbreaking thing is because no one tries to make it terrible.
No,
film.
Of course
people
not.
People embark on every one with the ambition to make something great. Yeah. They are a miracle to get made. But how you make sure that you don't make those five poor calls is a real trick.
Brilliant actors, and by that I mean, you know, all genders, there's just something about them where you go, I don't know, I just sort of believe. So this is a cliche, but if you take Gladiator, one of my wife's favourite films,
yeah.
you go... But Russell Crowe was really good in that. And I don't know Why? If you cast someone else and the opening scene when he's looking up at the bird on the tree and you think, you're just an actor in a stupid tunic, then the whole film would be rubbish.
That's so true.
So what is it? What have they got, this X factor where you go, I just sort of think you are a general.
yeah. Casting is 90% of it, really. I mean, you're absolutely right. And the quality that movie stars have. And you watch this, and it's really interesting as a director because sometimes you cannot see anything happening. Right. You're on set and you're looking at the scene and there's almost nothing happening. And then on the big screen, there is the complexity and the subtlety, the calibration of the subtlety. And it's why it's always, you feel nervous on set when something happens on set and the whole crew laugh or they go, oh, that was amazing. Because on set, it's like it's not theatre. The camera sees into the soul.
Yeah.
And so if you think of Gladiator and Russell Crowe, that's one of his great performances. It is in a triumph of his, you know, of overwhelming charisma and status and power, but then also vulnerability and emotion and fragility. Like he manages to navigate all that. And at that point in his career, at the peak of his capacity as a movie star. But I agree, you get the casting wrong. I mean, there's a terrible game that I heard some Hollywood actors talk about. And they talk about actors in terms of how many minutes of a film they can sustain. So they'll talk about an actor going, yeah, he's the full 100 minutes. But if an actor's not quite, they go, oh, no, they're about 50 minutes there. And this idea that there are great supporting actors that are 40, 50-minute actors, but who are the 100-minute actors that you? That's kind of mean, really, isn't it? And it denies the fact that actors can always surprise you, which I love. You can always cast an actor who's never done a massive role. And before you know it, they're, you know, transcending everything you ever thought they were doing.
But we're going to move out of your world and we're going to move on to your third choice, which is the song. So your song is being added to the Spotify Five My Life playlist. And it's Donny Hathaway's version of Marvin Gaye's hit What's Going On.
Amazing. It's kind of deeply embedded in meeting my wife.
Right. You know?
Yeah. So Jane is, it's funny, all of these questions you ask thread together because Jane is one of Australia's leading casting directors.
Right.
And she casts all my film and TV for 25 years. She's found all the actors. She finds new talent.
And you're still married?
And we're still married.
How long have you been married?
25 years.
Mate, bottle that. Yeah. Sell it. That's fantastic.
And she is incredible. Her parents were actors, Julia Blake and Terry Norris. She has a great instinct for cast and talent. And she has pushed me. You know, she was years ahead of the curve on diversity. She, you know, is great at picking big, established Australian actors that haven't done anything for a while, like Deborah Lee Furness in Force of Nature, who's incredible, but also finding new talent. Back when we first met, it was in the days, and I just find this, my kids find the nostalgia of this hilarious, but it was making mixtapes when you met someone. You'd make a tape and it would express your kind of love for them by making a tape full of songs that you loved that would tell a story. And it's incredible when you think of it, that now you can send a playlist, a Spotify playlist to people. Do people do that as a kind of love letter to each other, send playlists?
Yeah, I don't think so. And do you know the Hornby book where it's all about?
Yes.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like looking at someone's bookshelf. You go, you send me a mixtape and it's full of the Smiths and the House Martins. And you go, well, maybe this is going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Because we're cut from a similar cloth. But if it's all Barry Manilow and whatever else, you go, maybe we're not.
I know. It's a test, I guess. Is it? Do you like my taste in music? Can we? Anyway, on that tape was Donny Hathaway's take on that beautiful classic. And I'd never heard it. And I didn't know much about that era of music and that taste in music. And, you know, I remember kind of the falling in love with the soundtrack to falling in love with someone that I've shared my life with.
Yeah.
That song was there right at the beginning. So if I hear it playing, it's as evocative as a smell. Like because we lived in England, as I mentioned when I was little, there's a certain smell that that reminds me of winter, walking to school around this frozen lake, and it's probably the smell of like leaves and mulch, and it, if I smell it, it triggers 50 years back. I'm back there.
Yeah.
And music does it too. And so that song, yeah, I had to pick that song.
I just love that. That song isn't just music and notes. It's important, meaningful in your life.
That's right.
I have people, and Josh about this, and I only ever want to make my guests look good, but sometimes people, you know, that they think about their five and they choose it, and it always all relates to their work or something, and they come out and go, I didn't mention my husband. so you've ticked that box. So when Jane listens to this, she's a core central character.
Yeah,
I love it.
But she has been in my work and life, and you know, and you navigate that, a creative life, bringing up children, creating work, traveling, make, you know, and you don't know, obviously, early on, you know, when you're falling in love listening to Donny Hathaway, that, you know, you're going to share so much of your creative life together by working together. And it's not always easy. I think a lot of creative collaborations, I mean, we push each other.
Right.
I think one of Jane's strengths is that she can be quite provocative about choices in casting,
right?
And be bold. And I think her work has an aesthetic that is different. It's funny, people think, oh, if a different cinematographer shoots something, the film will definitely look different. But I think if a different casting agent casts it, it will feel different as well.
Yes.
I think choosing actors has an overall aesthetic sensibility. But the adventure of new talent, the adventure of finding and discovering new people and putting them in a job for the first time and seeing if they can do it. And the risk in that is, it's incredible. You know, it's that whole, the old adage of without risk, there is no art. You know, like you have to, I remember I did the film, the TV show, Christos Schulkes' book, Barracuda, for the ABC four-part miniseries. And the 17-year-old actor, Elias Anton, who's now gone on to have a career, young Lebanese boy, hasn't acted before. It's the lead in a four-part series. He's got to play an Olympic swimmer who wins the Olympic, you know, medal for butterfly, which is a tough stroke.
Yeah.
He's also got a, you know, and it's got massive complex issues of his sexuality. It's the most complicated role. And he hasn't not acted before. And I remember Jane looking at me going, there's some great actors that could play this role and the film would be okay. But if you go with Elias, it's either going to be one of two things. It's going to be a triumph or it's not going to work.
Right.
And it was provocative, her saying it to me, because she's saying, take that risk.
Yeah.
This guy's amazing. Yeah. And we did, and he was great. But I think, you know, I didn't take a cautious choice, and maybe I would have without her pushing me.
Now, I suspect we're going to change the tone because we're coming on to your place on Five My Life.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pronounce it wrong. You have chosen Balibo.
Yeah.
In East Timor.
Yeah.
And that is connected with not the most happy events, but tell us why you've chosen that.
Yeah, the complex career I've had and the many different projects over the year, there's one that just is the, you know, the life-changing experience, which was to make the film Balibo, about the tragedy of what happened to the Balibo 5 journalists who were murdered in the town of Balibo in 1975, but also the tragedy of what happened to East Timor, to Timor-Leste, and the tragedy of how we as a country abandoned them, and 200,000 people died. It's one of the dark blots on our national story, there is no doubt. And so to take a film crew to East Timor to make the film and to actually go to Balibo, the town, and to recreate the murder of the men. The young actors that play the Balibo 5 slept in the same building the men had in 75 had slept in. The Timorese army came and helped us recreate it. It was a phenomenal experience for me and, you know, like heartbreaking, really, to recreate that terrible event. But one of the things I took from the experience of going to East Timor was incredible optimism. It's a beautiful country, and for many of your listeners, somewhere to consider going for holiday. It's a 45-minute flight from Darwin. It's got beautiful snorkeling, surf, culture, an incredible tie between our two nations. Timorese people are beautiful. It's a wonderful place. And so since making the film, I took my daughter Kitty, who's now 21, when she was 12, just her and I went back to Timor after I'd made the film, went to Balibo. And in the Balibo fort, it's an old 400-year-old Portuguese fort, they've now built a little boutique hotel. And you can learn about the history, but you can also stay there. And so I took Kitty there and had that experience. And then several years later, my other daughter, Alice, went there on a volunteer program and went to Balibo, and I managed to get over at that time as well. And I feel like it's somewhere I'll just keep going back to. I feel connected in my creative life, having made that film, but also there's some magic in the place. It's something about transcending tragedy, and which is what that country's done, and not letting tragedy completely shape the future. Mm. I don't know how people do it. I don't know how that nation's done it. I think it takes great leadership. I think José Ramos Horta and Xanana Guzmán, some of the leaders of that country, have shown almost Mandela-like strength in leading their country beyond the tragedy of what happened. But also there's such joy and optimism in a country that is, you know, one of the poorest countries in Southeast Asia. It's one of our closest neighbours after PNG. Like, it really is an amazing part of our national story as Australians. So I think I'll always go there. You know, I'll probably go there again next year. I think they've played my films at the film festival. We took my kids' film Paper Planes to Balibo and played it there, dubbed in Tetun, their language. Right. So to be in the square in Balibo with all these kids throwing paper planes around, it's like a magnet, I guess. And maybe if I go off the rails in my creative life and I need to be challenged and reorient myself, it'll be like that place that will kind of, you know, I can settle there. I can go there and be reminded. Maybe it's a modesty and humility you get. You can be reminded that no matter how much you think it's important that you make films and that it's a drop in the ocean of something, that really the history, the big sweep of history, kind of transcends all of that.
The role of film done well to break through politics that I understand, that sometimes politicians, like dogs sniffing other dogs' backsides in a park. Yeah. They can't be independent. Yeah. It needs a talented, fiercely independent, creative filmmaker to shine a light on, I don't know, Gallipoli or Balibo, because the people who are actually in charge at that time ain't going to tell that story. I mean, they're not going to. So it needs
creative people. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you need, what is it? So the press is the fourth estate. What estate is film? The fifth estate or whatever. I think you need it, because they might make Marvel shite and all that stuff, but they also make important stuff that opens your mind and changes, you know, nations, because you go, we're not going to be doing that again.
It's great to hear you say that, because I believe that philosophically, you know, and I also think it can be very commercial. I think of a film like Oppenheimer,
yes,
which was a huge global success. And it's actually a political, historic film about the world grappling with the ethical and moral decisions there. The question I have about us as Australians, which is fascinating, is America made a lot of films about the Vietnam War within a few years of the war ending. So you think of great films like The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now, and then the more slightly more jingoistic anti-war films like Platoon, but there's a history of them that were made quite quickly. And very soon after the Vietnam War, America was talking about the catastrophe of it, the poor choices, the moral and ethical moribund choices that led to this catastrophic war. But in Australia, we make Gallipoli in 1977. So that took a hell of a long time. You know, I made Balibo in 2009. The events happened in 1975. I mean, for goodness sake, the Australian government that is in power now, both sides of politics, will still not reveal things that happened in East Timor in 1975. So next year's the 50-year anniversary. Yeah. As someone said to me, that's like in 1995, not knowing, 1995, not being honest about what happened in the last year of World War II.
Yeah.
Why 50 years down the track has the Australian government just not revealed everything? Why is it not history now? It's half a century. And yet there's still this, you know, and maybe it's the power of that event, you know, and what the Australian government knew was going on up there and what it was to sacrifice five journalists to some more pragmatic foreign policy. But fascinating as filmmakers. But no, I love to hear you say that. I believe, and I think audiences love it. I think political cinema has always been the engine room of a lot of conversation. You know, people enjoy you know, the opportunity to watch something and then to talk about it and to engage with it. And, you know, I'd love to see more of it. But we have to have risk in it. Again, you have to have risk. We're highly funded. You know, I was very fortunate with Balibo that the Australian government, even though it's embarrassing in lots of aspects, were still able to invest in it.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't, which is great, that they didn't censor my capacity to make it as a filmmaker.
The fifth choice is The Possession.
I should have brought it with me.
A Leica M240 240 camera.
Yeah, it's an older version of their digital cameras. It's kind of dated now. There's all manner of, I don't know, some people get sexy new technology. And I bought that camera when Paper Planes crossed $10 million at the box office, and I was very proud of that kids' film, which I made for my kids. And I went out and I bought myself that digital camera. I'm not a great photographer. I use it to study the world before I film somewhere. You know, I'm doing a film in Sicily, and I went there for 2 weeks last year with that camera and just went around. It was amazing. It was like a holiday, really. But I worked very hard, and I took my photos with it. And the camera is knocked around, beaten. It's got a beautiful lens on it, and I can't imagine replacing it. I look at new technology, and I look at the digital sensors have increased, and it's very seductive, isn't it? We all need to buy new phones every year. We all need to, you know, and somehow it kind of, again, it just centers me this kind of rough and tumble, battered, you know, the camera that I carry with me to every film and life and experience in life. And then I think something happens with a camera like that where you take photos that then become significant for you.
I love hearing you talk. So the pen that I've got in my hand now, I mean, it's my dad's. It's worth,
wow,
$2 and it's beaten up. But exactly as you say with the camera, you go, I could get a better one that doesn't leak, but it wouldn't be my dad's.
That's exactly it.
So when I write my note, I'm writing notes now, I mean, they mean slightly more, because when I write down always take the risk, that's still a good point whether I wrote it down with a Bic biro or my dad's fountain pen.
Yeah.
But it's a better point.
I love the image of you going to find the ink cartridges.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because a lot of the things we've talked about, it is that thing of where objects can hold memories or something. You know, I remember I did a documentary, this is completely off the track, but when I was in first year film school about witches, about witchcraft, and I met a lot of practitioners, and I met a psychometrist, and psychometrists are people that believe they can hold an object and that it has a resonate impact of something. So if their theory is that if, say, you go somewhere, you go to Auschwitz and you stand there and you feel the resonant tragedy of what happened there, their view is that objects can carry things, power, and metal particularly. So they have a very, it's like a kind of spiritual belief that an object carries something that you hold. Now, I don't believe that, but I do believe that objects trigger, like that pen you're talking about, your dad now. It triggers the memory, doesn't it?
You know, so what's the name of that?
Psychometry.
So I would agree with them when it comes to, I like an old village church. So in the English countryside,
yeah,
that's been there since the 11th century. Because when you are sitting there getting married or burying your mother, you go, these bricks have seen probably 700,000 other weddings and funerals.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like, I almost lean towards them, where you go, it's like the building knows more than you. It's seen all that stuff.
Yes.
For you, it's the biggest thing ever because I'm burying my mum. But you go, yeah, this is just one. Of centuries of funerals.
It's so true. We've just finished a film shooting over in WA, The Surfer with Nicolas Cage, which we produced, an Australian film. And we filmed in an amazing part of that Western Australia, Yelling Up, the beach there. And we did an incredible welcome to country with the traditional owners there of the land. And it's something the Australian film industry, you know, tried to get better at, to work out that we film on a lot of landscapes that carry incredible and profound history over many thousands of years. And there are burial sites there, you know, that are from the terrible historic period of colonisation there. And you feel it. And they say, please don't film. on these sand dunes here and these sand dunes here because they carry so much, and you do feel it. So I do think that some people are better connected to that. But I love the idea that physical objects can trigger things too. I love your pen, the story of your pen.
So you just dropped that you've just finished filming with Nicolas Cage.
I know, it was fun.
I saw 2 days ago Dream Scenario.
Oh, that's great.
It's a sensation. People were walking out. I wanted to grab them and say, what are you doing? And then you look on Rotten Tomatoes, and it's a film where you know you get the bar of people giving it 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 stars, 1 stars. And there's lots of fives and lots of ones.
Yeah.
The things that we were talking about earlier about if that film hadn't had Nicolas Cage in the lead role, it would have been shit.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's just utterly brilliant. I was totally gripped. So is this his next film after that?
Yeah, he's playing in a someone who's lived in America for about 50 years who returns to a small part of Australia and to go surfing, and the world's changed, and he takes his son surfing, and there's a territorial group of surfers who challenge him.
Right.
And it's made by an Irish filmmaker, Lorcan Finnegan. I look forward to showing it to the world, hopefully later this year. Amazing experience. And he's an incredible actor.
Yeah.
And disciplined. Like, I loved watching how he worked. I think, you know, he kind of treats himself like, what was he saying? It's like if you want to win an Olympic medal and you're a swimmer, well, to win an Olympic medal, you get up at 4 o'clock every day and you're in the pool for 3 hours and then you have a break. If you want to be one of the best actors, you need to treat your career like that. And that's how I watched him work.
Yeah.
And I love that because I think there's creative genius. He's one of the great actors. But sometimes you think, oh, is it just creative genius? And I love the fact that it's creative genius plus an incredible work ethic.
Yeah, discipline.
It kind of made me feel like it's okay. If I work harder.
Before we come on to the sixth choice, I'd like to ask you, tell us about a time where you got it wrong and what you learnt.
Ah, oh, that's fascinating, the idea of getting things wrong. I probably should, you know, in the spirit of talking about my work as a filmmaker, I think I made a film called $3 with David Wenham and Frances O'Connor and Sarah Winter. It's a very political film, actually, the second film I directed. And I've reflected on this since the film. I'm really proud of the film. But the duration of films is something people really talk a lot about. There's a lot of these really long films. But Peter Weir, I think, is Australia's greatest filmmaker. His films transformed our national cinema. There's not one that I don't love. And his director's cut of Picnic at Hanging Rock, so he comes back to Picnic at Hanging Rock years later and he does a director's cut, and it's 7 minutes shorter.
Right.
Because what he's learned as he's got further into his career is that you need less. Audiences are smarter. You can get away. It's a great discipline.
I love the note, the director's cut. I thought you were going to say it was 7 hours longer.
No.
Less.
It was
brilliant.
Less. And I look back at that film, $3, and I know that there is a sharper film in there.
Yeah, what a great answer, mate. Thank you for taking that on the chin. Isn't that great? But you know, life is not about perfection. It's about doing stuff.
Yeah.
And learning.
And they say, as a director, someone said to me, you have to treat all the films you make like your children. Of course, you've got a favourite, but you can never tell people which one it is. No, that's not true. You should treat them all equally.
Yeah.
Some grow up to be really successful, some less so. It doesn't matter. They're all your children. So I don't say that with any disrespect for that film because I actually love that film. I just know that as I've matured as a filmmaker, like Force of Nature is 10 minutes faster than The Dry.
Yes.
Like I've sharpened it up a bit.
Yeah.
I think you start realising that audiences can handle narrative plot. They're watching so much. Everyone's watching so much. We get it. Move on.
Yeah.
And now you can have the more evocative emotional stuff that people want. Don't get caught in the narrative mechanics because audiences are familiar now. They're smart. There's been 120 years of cinema. So that's probably something that I reflect on with a lot of my work.
Brilliant. The sixth choice is who would you like to hear on Find My Life next and why?
Trying to flip back across all the things we've talked about, I think right now leadership is the question the world is desperately reaching for. And I think the power of leadership is something that I admire in people. And I think we need desperately, you look at the battle that's about to happen in the United States, you look at our own political kind of dynamics, and you look at the environment and who are the great leaders in the environmental movement, like people who are going to shake the tree there. So I would immediately pivot to that conversation, someone who is a great leader, who is someone I would personally suggest, because I think if you can get him when he's in town, he's the president of East Timor now, José Ramos Horta.
Yeah.
So Horta, he's played in my film by Oscar Isaac. He's 24. His country's been invaded. His party says,
great suggestion.
You've got to go to the United Nations and represent us. He flies to the UN. The stories are incredible. He's never seen snow before. He turns up in the UN. His country's been invaded. The UN give him a seat at the table. And 25 years later, he leads his country to independence and returns to Timor for the first time.
Mate,
and
that, lock it in.
Let's do it. Let's make an introduction.
No, please.
I think if you could talk to him about leadership, he's also great on the pragmatic nature of leadership. Like, he led his country after 1999 in the way Mandela led South Africa. He didn't appeal to the need for revenge and for... He had truth and reconciliation.
I would love to interview him.
But he's also like a very erudite and engaged thinker about Australia, and provocative, and he's led that country and then stepped back to retire, and he's returned, and he's, you know...
Sensational six choice. Robert Connolly, thank you. I've adored this conversation, whether it's hearing about your optimism, or I love the five choices that can make a film great or good, or I just, every film is a miracle. You've got to contemplate works of art beyond the actual works of art itself, beyond the book, beyond the film. It's just take risks. There's so much wisdom in this conversation. I'm really looking forward to re-listening to it. But for now, can I just say thank you so much for sharing on Find My Life.
It's been amazing to chat with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the show. And thank you for all your messages with guest suggestions and feedback on the episodes. The Five of My Life audience really is a lovely, engaged community. Please do keep the messages coming in. The best way is through my website. And if you have a friend who you feel might enjoy a particular guest, please do forward the episode on. I do the show on my own, so without a marketing budget, word of mouth really is the only way of people discovering the show.